This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hobman. So focus on what the media, and I'm talking about electronic media, iPhones and devices are doing to our kids, and what we can and should be doing about it as teachers, parents, grandparents, because recently an open letter from JANA Partners, an activist investment group, and the California State Teachers Retirement System urged Apple to enact some safeguards. And with us today, Dr. Michael Rich. So what is Apple not doing that they should be doing? And by the way, Apple issued a kind of a robust defense. They said, and I'm reading from an article in the Wall Street Journal, Apple Inc. defended its record of providing parental controls and other protections for children who use its iPhones. They say that there's plenty of ways to shape and limit content. There are apps that are abound out there. There's a lot of ways that if only parents would really engage with their kids' iPhone use and device use, that they could, satisfactorily shape it. So what's your take on that?
Well, I think that this is an understandable response from a major corporation that is currently trying to move from what has been the traditional stance of those who are making media and technology essentially defending themselves against child advocates, as much as anything for legal and liability reasons.
Right. They got to say something.
Exactly. They have to say something. But the reality is that the tools that they have are really binary, and they're essentially saying, if you don't like it, shut it off. And there's more nuance to it than that, but the flip side of it is that what ends up happening is the same thing that happened with the V chip in televisions, which is that, a lot of legislative effort and a lot of technological effort went into creating a chip that would be responsive to the ratings of television shows to limit the television shows that kids were exposed to. Except here's the problem. First of all, very few people even knew that the chip was in their television. And second of all, they didn't know how to set it. I mean, these are the same people who had VCRs that were flashing 12 o'clock all the time, right? And so if someone wanted to know how to set it, they would ask their kid, right?
Exactly.
So calling
IT, and IT is a 13-year-old.
Exactly. And so here's the dilemma, which is that parents recognize that these kids are much more facile with the devices than they are, and they don't even step into that realm with them. They don't parent them in that realm where they are spending more and more of their time. And so what we are hoping that Apple will do, and I am genuinely optimistic that they will come here, is that they will realize that we're not attacking them, we're not criticizing them, we're not blaming them for hurting children so much as we're saying, bring your incredible expertise and your incredible design sense to bear on an issue that is increasingly on parents' minds, but give those parents the education and empower them with the tools to be able to enter that world with their children and parent them in it. Because parenting is not about saying no or yes to everything. It is not a binary thing. It is a series of risk-benefit analyses, letting kids try things, picking them up when they scrape their knee, teaching them, and letting them try again. And that's what we need to be able to let them do in that environment, you know, in the digital environment. And so I am hopeful that Apple will not back into the defensive stance that is unfortunately reminiscent of the one that the tobacco companies took, where they said, we don't know that this is an effect, we don't know that this is hurting our kids, but instead to say, let's be responsive to our consumers, let's listen to them, let's listen to their concerns, and let's bring the best data we have to bear on this issue, and let's problem solve it. The whole idea behind the founding of the Center on Media and Child Health, which is based at Boston Children's and Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health, is to move out of the advocacy role, the, you know, sort of up on a soapbox saying, don't hurt our kids, and build an evidence base, much as we have for injury prevention or for nutrition, of unbiased research that looks at the positive and negative effects of the media we use and how we use them. And let's use that as a big tent where all of the stakeholders can come together, roll up their sleeves, and work the problem from their different disciplines, because we will do better in synergy with each other than in isolation from and opposition to each other.
So some practical questions. And by the way, you have an online resource for parents, because, you know, this is a really terra incognita for a lot of parents. They, you know, don't know where to turn for advice. They can't ask their parents. You know, traditional wisdom that's been passed along through, you know, through the generations doesn't apply here. They probably shouldn't ask their kids. And so, right? And you've got online an Ask the Mediatrician website. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I've been doing this for so long that I became known as the Mediatrician, you know. And what I found is that when I would present our research to parent groups or to even industry and professional groups, that at the end of the talk, everybody would sort of crowd the stage and say, I have this question about my son, I have this question about my daughter. And I realized that there's so many questions out there, even from people who have a great deal of expertise in one part of this, that there seemed to be a role for essentially a Dear Abby for parenting in the digital age, because many of these questions were quite universal. You know, when should I give my kid a smartphone? I even got a question about how do I get my 10-year-old son to quit singing Viva Viagra in the supermarket? And, you know, and everything in between. And, you know, and we tried to answer them based in the research, in ways that are balanced, that are not blaming and shaming and saying this is bad or good, but saying here are the things that you can expect from, you know, where this will lead. Here are the things to be concerned about. Here are the things to seek out, and that are feasible. There are things you can do right now. You don't have to buy a device or read a book or take a course, but you can do right now at home. Because we are dealing with a very much evolving environment. And so the questions that I was getting at Ask the Mediatrician 5 years ago are frankly quite different than the ones that I'm getting today, because the issues that parents are facing are different.
Yeah,
exactly.
Do you agree, you're a pediatrician, do you agree with your professional organization that their suggestion is that you virtually limit or not have any, zero tolerance for screen time before a certain age? I think it's the age of 2, isn't it? You know, where because it somehow screws up the developmental pathways. The kids don't really play in real space. They don't develop the requisite 3D navigational skills that are, you know, it's part of the developmental portfolio of humans.
I think that any kind of draconian absolute don't do before a certain age is problematic for many of the same reasons that we were talking about the forbidden fruit. And quite frankly, those recommendations that first came out from the American Academy of Pediatrics in 1999 were built entirely on TV data, TV viewing data.
Yeah, yeah.
So the interactive, you know, tablet or smartphone use has indicated, you know, the early findings are that there may be some useful learning under the age of 30 months, which is where the breakpoint seems to be for television, for purely receptive screens. So I think the jury's still out on at what point it's a problem. The other thing is, it's easy to interpret that as saying screens are toxic for your child under this age.
Yeah.
And I think to be more realistic and more honest to the neurodevelopmental science, the fact of the matter is, those things that help build strong, capable, resilient, flexible brains, which is happening very rapidly in the first 2 or 3 years of life, where, you know, we are making billions of synaptic connections and, frankly, reinforcing the synaptic connections that are useful and used and pruning away those that are not so used, that we know that there are three things that are very, very positive for these brains. The first is interacting with other human beings, mom, dad, et cetera. Second is acting on and manipulating our physical environment, stacking up the blocks or getting that Cheerio into your mouth. And the third is open-ended free play, problem-solving play, et cetera. None of these screens give you any of those things. Mm-hmm. They give you basically poor analogs of these things, like for finger painting. You know, you can get a finger painting app on a on an iPad, but it's not the same as
it's not as tactile.
It's not as tactile. You can't smell it. Mm-hmm. You can't get that wonderful reaction when you smear it on your brother's face. You know, there's so many richer environmental things. So what we're saying really is that this is a relatively impoverished environment for neurodevelopment compared to what a lot of people think of as doing nothing, right?
Yeah, just
and
free range
exactly,
kids. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and I think that's one thing. Let me also talk about the idea of screen time above that age, because the other thing that went out with that recommendation was 1 to 2 hours of quality educational screen time per day for kids. In today's world, where we are communicating with smartphones, where kids are getting homework on online, where they're handed tablets in many of their schools, etc., the concept of screen time has really become obsolete. Because first of all, how do you as a parent determine what's quality and educational? You know, how do you as a parent essentially get forced into policing your child who is, quote, doing homework, but while she's writing that English paper, maybe downloading music and chatting with friends and, you know, snapping with them, etc. So what we feel that the data show and what we are doing in our clinical work is suggesting that instead of doing, you know, you have 1 hour of screen time a day, because what ends up happening with that is it becomes the forbidden fruit. The kid does it the moment they come home from school, and an hour later, nothing happens. An hour, 15 minutes later, mom comes in and says, hey, you got to do your homework. Oh, I want to finish this program. Oh, I want to level up in this game. And it becomes a conflict every single time. So what we're talking about is to sit down with your child, and you can do this with a child as young as 5 or 6, and think of their 24-hour day as an empty glass that they fill up with the things that they need to do. You need this many hours of sleep a night, you know, and sleep is one of the things that suffers first from media use. A sit-down family meal every day, which is the single most protective thing you can do with for your child, not just for his or her nutrition, but for their mental health as well. And when a screen is on during that time, all of those benefits disappear, both the eating benefits and the mental health benefits. So do it without a device. You like to play outside. Let's put aside some time for playing outside. You have this much homework a day. Do this. And then see at the end what's left. And you're doing a couple of things here. Number one is you're giving your child ownership of and modeling of prioritization and time management.
Time management,
and
God, which is a key God skill. Knows, yeah, yeah.
God knows we all could do better at that.
Yep.
And you're modeling it for them. You're helping them choose so they own that schedule. They are mindfully using media, not sliding into it with every available mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. They're also
it
not
It doesn't become the default, in other words.
Exactly. And here's another concern I have about it being a default, which is that today's kids do not get bored. Okay? And boredom is where creativity and imagination happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Instead, they fill that empty space. Instead of letting that empty space and that discomfort that makes mm-hmm. them feel, have them think new thoughts, they fill it with other people's thoughts.
Yeah.
Whatever pings in at them. And so I think that we have to take a step back and recognize that if you look at the history of creativity, whether it's in the arts or in science, or it happened when people had the space to think and to reflect. And the other thing that is impinging on our ability to think reflectively is that we're now entering a mode where people don't learn things and retain them because they can Google them. They don't learn about the Battle of Hastings or about photosynthesis because they can always look it up. But then they don't have the building blocks to put together in new and creative ways. They don't have the ability to go inside their own head and say, well, what if, you know, or what if what happened in Macbeth can teach me something about, you know, the altercation I'm having with a kid at school. And so I think we really have to take a step back and understand that these things, and I'm gesticulating with my smartphone as I speak, these things are tools. They are tools that are very powerful, that can give us a lot of range and freedom and power, but they also are tools that, if not used in a mindful and directed way, can harm us. Just as an automobile is a very powerful tool that can harm if used wrong. But if we go back to how we learn to drive, how we teach our children to drive, we don't get them behind the wheel of the car and say, don't hit that tree, don't run over anybody. We say, you know, let off on the clutch, you know, go forward, steer this way. We teach them to drive, to master the art of driving, and in the process, they learn not to hit the tree. That's a very different thing than we do when we, you know, if we take the time at all to introduce them to the internet, we're often talking about internet safety as if the internet is a dangerous place that needs to be defended against, instead of talking about internet mastery, which is what I think we really need to be teaching kids, because when you master something, you are safe there, but you also are able to enjoy it, you're able to exercise your power within it, and you're able to be creative with it.
Well, that's very well said. And, you know, there are perils that lurk on the internet. There are online predators, there are scams, there's invasions of privacy, bullying, the risk of early sexualization via the internet. I mean, these are real issues that we have to grapple with in a rational way without, again, a total prohibition, making it forbidden fruit. And I think that these are issues that, you know, your center is certainly addressing. So give us once again some of the resources. By the way, one of your colleagues, who I believe was also involved in the JANA open letter, Professor Twenge has written, am I pronouncing the name correctly?
That's correct, yep.
Twenge has written a book about iGen. Is that mm-hmm. something that you recommend
That's
people
correct.
Take a look at?
With a caveat that it is really more negative than I would be about it all, mm-hmm. and more of a warning book. But, you know, that's what it takes to sell books. you know, that you've got to create a controversy, you know. And as P.T. Barnum once said, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Okay. But I think that if parents are feeling that they need to be made aware of the dangers, it's one place to look. I don't think it's the whole story. And I think that we have to be very careful about making the devices, the applications, or the people that make them the dark side of life. You know, human nature is human nature in the digital space and in physical space. And we are going to act out in all those ways, whether they be bullying or sexual, you know, seduction, or reaching out and connecting with people in deep and meaningful ways. It is not the technology that does it, it is us. Pogo was right. We have met the enemy and he is us. And we need to understand that it's not the technology, but our behaviors with those technology that either puts us at risk or makes us, it puts us in touch with the better angels of our nature.
Indeed. So you recently recorded an interview with 60 Minutes. Where can people, when do you think that's going to air and when can people get a look at it?
Oh my goodness, I don't know.
Okay,
I suspect it'll be sometimes this spring. Yeah, I suspect. But I have no control over CBS.
Well, you did do a very nice interview with NPR, so that's available, I think, on their website.
That is available. Yeah. And actually, if people come to our website at cmch.tv, all of these are posted on that website. So if they want to get a bunch of different angles on this, those are all posted there.
Okay, so cmch.tv. That
correct.
Stands for the Center on Media and Child Health. And
yep.
If people Google Ask the Mediatrician, they'll be directed to your column, correct?
That's correct. And I encourage your listeners to ask questions, see if you can stump the Mediatrician. But I do think that this is an ongoing dialogue for all of us because we're all in this together. And I learn as much from my patients and from my readers as they learn from me, in the sense that we are crowdsourcing experience here. For example, when we write a piece for Ask the Mediatrician, oftentimes on our Facebook site, people will get into a dialogue around it because they'll try something. It may not work in their community because of certain rules in the community or whatever, and they will add their twists on it. So in some ways, it's like cooking with Epicurious.com, where as the recipe gets more and more comments, the recipe gets better and better.
People start riffing on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're in this together, and we have to lean on each other for our different, you know, experiences and different trials and errors. And this is one of the great uses of the internet, which is how can we bring people together from disparate experiences to solve a shared problem?
Okay, well, it's an issue. It's not going away, that's for sure, and we need to cope with it. I think that's the big take-home message for today. Thank you very much, Dr. Michael Rich. And thank you for being so generous with your time. I know you're in demand in the wake of this controversy about Apple, and you've certainly done the media rounds. Audience appreciates it very much.
Well, I appreciate you listening, and I will especially appreciate yours and your listeners' questions and dialogue going forward.
Thank you so much. That's Dr. Michael Rich. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.